the apostolic constitutions represent a kind of an amalgamation of several of the documents we've already seen. It includes elements that are taken from the Didache, but in particular from the apostolic tradition of Hippolytus, which is cited literally on a number of occasions. And so we don't need to look at this document in as much detail as perhaps we did the earlier ones, except to note the differences, the development that has taken place in the understanding of the clergy, and even the new inclusion among the clergy and the designation of those who are instituted by the laying on of hands of individuals who were formerly regarded as in a somewhat different category. So by the 4th century, and remember now the church is legal, one now has a church which is not only tolerated, this is probably from the middle or latter part of the 4th century, a church that is fast becoming the dominant religion of the new Christian Roman Empire. In this context, there is an expansion of and an understanding of clerical ranks and of specific ministries that allows for a more specific definition, both of their office and of their relationship to one another. So we'll look rather briefly at selections from this rather extensive document, noting again that it will describe itself as being of apostolic origin, even to the extent of claiming that particular sections are written by different apostles. Again, this is rather amusing, but really doesn't have much to do with history, strictly speaking. If we look at the very beginning, at the ordination of a bishop, there is still, as we saw in the tradition of Hippolytus, the participation by the people. Let the principal of the bishops in paragraph 2 ask the presbytery and the people whether this is the person they desire for their ruler, and then they give their consent. Now this is more kind of a formality than an election process, but there is an acknowledgement of the right to be ordained and a necessary participation in this proclamation by the whole of the Christian assembly. A kind of an opportunity for people to acknowledge the fitness of the individual and perhaps also to raise objections if they had some. If we drop down to section 5, there's a description of the form of prayer for the ordination of a bishop, which we've already seen in the apostolic tradition of Hippolytus. But notice that it includes very specific descriptions of the bishop's function, which include to remit sins. The bishop is still the principal, the sole regulator of the restoration to communion of those who have fallen into schism or heresy or serious sin. It is the bishop's responsibility to distribute the portions according to the Lord's command. That would be a liturgical reference to the Eucharist, and also a reminder of the bishop's responsibility to distribute to the poor, to those who have particular needs, and then to loose every bond. Not just to remit sins, but to remit other kinds of penalties that might have been imposed as well. And then especially number 4, the very explicit description of the offering of the Eucharist as offering to God a pure and unbloody sacrifice. A very early 4th century use of terminology that will become very standard throughout the Middle Ages. If we then look at the next section down, chapter 11, the form of prayer for the faithful, marked in a blue bar, you'll see that there's the description of the kiss of peace. And if we continue on down a little further, in highlighted text, here again we find the preface dialogue, which is familiar to us, the Lord be with you, and also with you lifting up your heart, and giving thanks to the Lord, and then a very specific description after the preface of the words of institution. Unlike the Disciplina Arcana, the kind of reticence in the very early church to describe the words of institution lest they be misunderstood, here they are plainly and clearly described. We have a clear description of the canon of the Mass, the center of the Eucharistic celebration. Then, in section 3, chapter 16, there is a description of the ordination of presbyters, and one has to bear in mind again that, as one had in the apostolic tradition of Hippolytus, the Eucharistic celebration that we've just looked at is primarily that would have accompanied the ordination of a bishop. Here, the ordination of presbyters is described The laying on of hands is also explicitly mentioned. And if one then drops down to the ordination of deacons, here too the laying on of hands is described. And what is particularly interesting, in chapter 19, after the deacon comes the appointment of a deaconess. The importance of these women who served in assisting at the baptismal liturgy and are also probably involved in catechesis, in teaching women Christian doctrine during the period of preparation for baptism. This is becoming much more important in the church of the 4th century, in the legal Christian church, because of course now there's the need for greater and more intensive catechesis. Huge numbers of people are pouring into the Christian church, and provision must be made both for their teaching by the bishop, but now also by others who are involved in instruction, and also to make sure that everything is above board and appropriate at the ceremony of baptism. So the role of the deaconess as one who is involved in that liturgical function is particularly highlighted, and the deaconess is ordained by the laying on of hands. Now, I've used that term. In fact, the term ordination, strictly speaking, is often reserved for the higher offices. If you drop up and notice the ordination of deacons, the deacon is ordained kairotonia by laying on of hands. The deaconess receives the epithes tas kairos. She receives the laying on of hands. But the word kairotonia, the specific word ordination, is actually avoided. So although there is an institution, I've described it, you know, rather generically and probably incorrectly as an ordination, there is a ceremony of laying on of hands that clearly is involved in the office of deaconess, even though there does appear to be a little reticence to use exactly the same terminology in describing the ceremony in regard to a deaconess than there was in regard to a deacon. And there is Old Testament precedent mentioned in number 20, in particular women who served in the tabernacle of old, and a description of the gift of the Holy Spirit to be cleansed from all filthiness, worthily discharge the work that is appointed to her. There is a purification both of the individual and a kind of ministry of purification, which is a classical way that both baptismal catechesis and the ceremony of baptism were themselves described. Now again, bear in mind that the baptism itself was performed solely by the bishop. Baptism was an episcopal function. It involved a sacramental sealing with myrrh, with the sweet-smelling oil at the very end, which concluded it, and it would be not a very long time before the vast numbers of people requiring baptism made it possible for baptism to be delegated. But at this stage, in the 4th century, baptism is still the exclusive prerogative of the bishop, and it is the assisting at baptism which is the specific responsibility of the deaconess and of the deacon. There's also the description of the office of subdeacon, who is helping the deacon in the handling of the vessels at the altar. And here the word kairotonia, the specific ordination word, is used in regard to the subdeacon, which we saw was also used of the deacon, but that particular word was not used of the deaconess. Here, of course, the subdeacon is ordained with the laying on of hands. If one looks at the lector is appointed, not ordained, but appointed by laying on of hands. This is probably more parallel to how the office of deaconess is seen, not exactly as parallel to the deacon, but rather more like the ministries that one finds among lector, and as we'll see, among others, particularly exorcists, although in this context, the exorcist is specifically not ordained. After lector, there is now a description of confessor, and notice what is different here from what one found in the Liturgy of Hippolytus. Confessors are a real and continuing to be developed rank within the church, because people are being persecuted still at the time of the apostolic tradition of Hippolytus. This now is the legal church, and so confessors are a historical remnant, people who suffered in the past but their ranks are not being replenished. And intriguingly here, the confessor is to be ordained, is to receive a laying on of hands if he is made a bishop or a presbyter or a deacon. So at this stage, the confessor cannot simply function as a presbyter. He must receive the laying on of hands if he is to exercise these offices. And then we drop down a little further to other individuals who are not ordained, but are regarded as having ministries in the church. And that would include virgins who are enrolled among the widows, who are participating in the community of the widows, and then a more explicit description of widows. They are not ordained, that is to say, they do not receive a laying on of hands. Then in regard to exorcists, so those who are continuing a ministry of healing, they too may function, and they do not receive a laying on of hands for that. Then there's a specific description in chapter 27 of the fact that a bishop needs to be ordained by two or three other bishops. So it isn't just one bishop ordaining a bishop that will suffice. There needs to be representation of participation by the local church. Then there's a description of distinctions between bishop and presbyter and deaconess. Again, a clarification of their role. The bishop blesses but does not receive blessing, lays on hands, ordains, offers, and receives blessing from bishops, but he does not receive a blessing from presbyters. A presbyter blesses, but does not receive a blessing. He receives a blessing from bishop or from a fellow presbyter, but the bishop does not lay on. That is to say, the presbyter does not lay on hands to ordain. He does lay on hands in the rite of an ordination of a presbyter. So there is an attempt to articulate through liturgical function of distinctions between these ranks. The presbyter will lay on hands at a presbyteral ordination, but he does not ordain. He does not engage in this specific institution of clergy. The deacon does not lay on hands. The deaconess does not bless or perform anything belonging to the office of a presbyter or deacon, but her role, it specifically says, is to keep the doors and to minister to the presbyters in the baptizing of women on account of decency. So an explicit description of the role and function of the deaconess. The deacon separates, decides where people are to be within the church, in terms of where the clergy and those involved in ministries stand and take part in the ritual, and that is a principal function of the deacon. Then there's a description rather parallel to what we saw in Hippolytus, the blessing of water and of oil, of first fruits and of tithes, and the specific description of alms and how they are to be used, that they are to be distributed to the clergy, which clergy receive what portion of them, and then how they are also to be apportioned to those who are being maintained by the church for their own ministries, such as subdeacons, readers, singers, that is to say psalmists as they're literally described, cantors as we would say today, and deaconesses. So the gifts that are offered are maintaining of the clergy and those involved in ministry.